and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. And
Introduce yourself.
You don't understand. Precalculus has fried my brain. I'm Spencer, and with me is, well, I think he might be a mole for the Boston mob, but I don't know. He seems like a good cop.
Wait, which one am I now? There's a mole. There's not a mole.
There are two moles. It's a double
mole. You're making
mole.
Me Matt Damon?
Yeah.
I guess I'll take it. Anyway, I'm Joel. I'm not actually Matt Damon.
Yeah, so this is the second half of the 2006 pairing, which is The Departed, the Oscar Best Picture winner, and Inside Man. And with us for the first chat is returning guest for her third appearance on here, Jan Ratcliffe.
Hello!
Hi, so when I sent you the list for the second half of the season, what made you want to pick this one?
Because it's great.
Okay.
I am a, not that this is a controversial statement or anything, but I am a big Martin Scorsese fan. It was a little strange when the whole, so-called scandal last year of, mm-hmm. are you a Marvel fan or are you a Scorsese fan broke. I was kind of in the middle, but after a certain point, I kind of fell on the side of Scorsese. Not so much in the, you're right, these movies aren't that great. Just clearly he's the better filmmaker in every possible way to all the people who make the Marvel movies. And this one is just one of those movies that you see it and it just kind of lingers in your mind. It's one of his countless movies about the mafia. I think this might have been his fifth movie about the mafia out of about 40 movies. So yeah. that was another claim that people who can't be arsed to look up IMDb is that he only makes movies about the mafia.
Yeah, that shit was real annoying.
Yeah, but it was exceedingly annoying.
Yeah, I thought the controversy you're talking about was the fan cut to cut out the quote unquote horrible shot at the end of the movie. Remember?
About the rat.
Yeah, some people are.
I like the rat. I think it's funny. I think the only thing that would have been better is if panned out and Martin Scorsese just turns the camera and says "crime doesn't pay" and winks. and then just goes to black right then and there.
I think I would have liked that better. Not that I have a problem with the rat, but I'm always up for it. A fourth wall breaking director appearance.
Yeah, and he has shown up in some of his movies, so it would be completely out of character for him to appear in this one.
Yeah. This time it should have been the same shot of Joe Pesci shooting at the camera, except
exactly.
It was Martin Scorsese dressed as a rat shooting the camera.
Exactly, exactly. I love it. He should have done that.
Joel, did you see us in the theater? What's your track record with The Departed?
I don't think I saw it in the theater, actually. What year are we in?
2006. I was 15. I was a freshman
really
in high
weird.
School,
I wonder,
I think.
I don't remember seeing it in the theater. That doesn't mean I didn't, but 2006 was more my video game phase, I didn't really get into movies until probably the break of 2010, and then that became everything to me. But, I neglected a ton of stuff in favor of just playing new video games all the time and talking about video games all the time instead. So when I first saw this, it was on DVD, and I've only seen it twice. This is only the second time I've seen it.
Okay.
And I really like it. I don't think I like it as much as some people do. I think it's... Let me think. I don't think it's as good as Casino. And Goodfellas, when it comes to his gangster stuff. But I still think... it's just a solid movie, You put it on, you watch it. There's one thing that upsets me about this movie. And I'm just going to put it out on the table right now. Mark Wahlberg is so good in it, it makes me upset that I like him in it.
He is, and he's good in this, and he's good in Boogie Nights. He's great in Boogie Nights, and he can act, and he just chooses not to much of the time.
Right, and like in his personal comment, you know, on life and stuff like that, it's not a person I would ever want to hang out with. I don't want to ever hang out with Mark Wahlberg, but put him in a movie, I'm like, ooh, is he going to say something?
It's like, oh no, he's a good actor. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. He is great in this. You know, and he's pretty much only the only character that makes it to the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I first saw this late high school. My cousin had it on DVD. And we watched up until when Leo fights the people in the diner, little bodega place. And my cousin's little sister was probably like 7 or 8. And she walked in and my aunt was like, turn that off. Stop watching that. And so this is the first time I have seen it in full. And like after that point, I was like, I'll watch this again eventually. And so I'm kind of really happy that I got to finally had an excuse to sit down and watch this after like, I really enjoy it. Just like, is this one of those things like, yeah, I'll get to it eventually. And thankfully, Gina, you forced that eventually to happen.
Well, I'm glad I could take part in that. I actually saw this when I was still just getting movies from Netflix in the mail. So that was, I did not see this in the theater, so this probably would have been 2007, 2008 that I'd finally gotten around to seeing it. And it was definitely one of those, like, I messaged, like 5 people immediately afterwards, have you seen The Departed? Have you seen The Departed? Have you seen The Departed? And just like, if you haven't seen it, you need to see it right now.
That's the way Sarah feels about this. Like, this is, when I said I'd only seen it twice, she was like, oh, after I watched it the first time, I watched it like 3 more times right away after that. And I was like, oh, okay. But and she took it to her dad to see because she knew he would get a kick out of it and stuff like that. So I got a departed lover in the house with me.
Oh. Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's weirdly funny. It's disorienting because they do. And one thing I really love about it is that Matt Damon and Leonardo DiCaprio don't really look all that much alike, except for being kind of, you know, bland, blonde-haired, blue-eyed white guys. But they look enough alike here that it's disorienting.
I'll be honest. I confused them a few times in the maybe first 30 minutes.
I think that was absolutely intentional.
Oh, okay, and seeing Mark Wahlberg show up is like, even he looks the same, but he has floppy hair, so he stuck out between those two.
Yeah, I didn't have a problem. Matt Damon has an attractive face, and I don't get the Leonardo DiCaprio attraction thing, so, you know.
Well, clearly you weren't like a teenage girl who went to go see Titanic, so.
No, that's the problem. No, I've had it out for him ever since Titanic because my high school girlfriend at the time was just, oh, I can't get enough of it. Let's go see Titanic for the 4th time. And I'm like, someday, Leonardo, you're going to get it. And this is what this podcast is about.
Oh,
I mean, definitely, Scorsese intended on casting actors that favored each other because before Matt Damon was cast, it was supposed to be Brad Pitt playing that character. And again, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, handsome in a kind of generic sort of way. And again, I think that, you know, Spencer and other people had, you know, sometimes confusing the characters for each other. I think that was 100% intentional. I think that's very clever.
I was thinking that at some point. But, Brad Pitt was a producer on this, which was the first time I was like, oh, he's been producing, like, big shit for a while. Like, I thought that was only for recent.
He's got a very good eye for scripts to produce.
Yeah, this is...
Yeah, I saw he produced The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Is that what that one's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, and 12 Years a Slave, and a lot of other movies that might not necessarily have gotten made. Yeah, he's got a very good eye for that kind of thing.
Yeah, and this... he's had two win Best Picture that he's produced, too, which is a pretty good track record. At least two. The Departed and 12 Years a Slave. But, since we all like this, like, let's just get all the negatives out of the way first, so we end on a good note.
All right, Spencer, what's negative? Wrong.
I don't really know. can't really think of
anything. I can't think of anything. I mean, I think it's a very tightly paced, very clever, little crime thriller.
I had a problem loosely
based on real events and real people, but I think that it became its own animal.
Yeah, I had a problem with how casually they handled time jumps. Like, you could tell time had passed with Matt Damon because of promotions and stuff like that. Leonardo DiCaprio was much harder to tell when time was passing, except for when he interacted with, say, what is the actress who played the therapist?
Vera Farmiga.
Interacting with her because of her association with Matt Damon. She went from her boyfriend to moving in to being engaged. I don't know if they... I assume they were married. I don't know.
He mentions they're getting married at one point later on.
Right. Yeah. But otherwise, sometimes it was just unclear how much time had passed. And, like, I think there were some times where it was a great amount of time had actually passed.
I didn't...
I think the movie opens at what the scene with Matt Damon, that's supposed to be in the 70s, and then the rest of the movie takes place in the present, 2005, let's say. So yeah, that's a little jarring.
I didn't have any trouble with the pacing. Well, not pacing, the time jumps. I think why I was pretty okay with it was just like, you know from the get-go, this will be like a big epic story, and so like, you can't really tell epic story like this in a short amount of time. So like, I adjusted pretty quickly to like, oh yeah, it's been like 4 months. It's been a year. Like it wasn't too distracting for me.
Mm. Well, that's the thing. A lot of Scorsese movies, they very rarely take place in just one, specific period of time, like Goodfellas and movies like that. That's over 20 to 30 year period of time. So that's definitely a trope for him.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually what's something that makes The Inside Man unusual is that it. It's basically the day of the bank robbery and then, a day of follow-up in that one. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's like a huge problem with the movie. That was just something I noticed this time watching. There was one scene that felt like it probably was meant to go before a different scene. The scene where Vera Farmiga... has a box and she's moving into Matt Damon's place and he like takes out that picture or he's like, what is this picture? I don't have personal pictures around. You can't have this stuff. And he puts the box back or puts the picture back in the box. The scene after that, Leo shows up at her house and pulls that picture out of a box that's at her apartment. So did she take that box back to the apartment for some reason?
I thought she was slowly moving. I thought it was she wasn't fully moved in yet because there's a brief mention of she has like a few weeks left on the lease.
Well, yeah, but she wasn't. She already took that box over to Matt Damon, so that was part of the move, I would assume, right?
Or maybe she took it back home or wherever.
That's what I'm saying. She must have taken it back home for it to not be a weird time thing.
I'm just looking at the trivia here, and it's funny how many different actors were considered for Mark Wahlberg's role before it was offered to Mark Wahlberg. You have Ray Liotta, Dennis Leary, and Ethan Hawke, which would have been an interesting choice.
Any of them could have done that, really. But that special sauce that Mark Wahlberg puts on the
they went with the right person. It's just, you know, it's interesting to speculate that. And I just feel like with, you know, that's kind of role that like Ray Liotta could do in his sleep. And right. So it was good to see Mark Wahlberg, you know, actually again prove that he was capable of acting if he felt like doing so.
Yeah, if you'd said Ray Liotta was going to do the Alec Baldwin role, I could have also seen that. But man, I also pretty much love Alec Baldwin in this too, with this, especially that scene where he, can I talk to you for a minute? It just starts to strangle.
Yeah. Pure Cinema podcast did Scorsese series last year, I think. Like, went over all of his movies and paired it with something else, and like they're pointing out that The Departed is like it's basically Scorsese's like popcorn movie, because like before this it was like Bring Out the Dead, the Aviator, Kundun, and it's like as a stretch of like more serious
more ambitious. I mean, this is really ambitious, so I don't know, but
yeah, but it still had like that popcorn, like very mainstream appeal to it.
Sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it moves very quickly. I think it would be it would appeal to people who don't normally like quote unquote mafia movies. Which I think is something that Scorsese is particularly good at. Like, a lot of people say, oh, I don't like mafia movies, but I like Goodfellas. Or because when you think mafia movies, you think kind of, you know, very long, not bad, but just very, you know, very long drive movies like The Godfather and The Untouchables. And then you've got, you know, Goodfellas, which is very, you know, something is constantly happening. And I think that's, you know, that's the same structure that this follows. And it's, like, unexpectedly funny, and it's, you know, it's unexpectedly bleak, but, all you know, somehow these all work together.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's, you know, it's startlingly violent in a couple points. Like, that whole scene at the end with the elevators, I mean, that's just, like everything happens so fast. It's just like you have to watch it more than once to catch. Okay, now this guy. Wait, now this guy's shooting. Now that guy's shooting. Wait, now who's this guy again? Oh wait, this guy's a mole too, and it's just it's all you know. It's you know, entertainingly overwhelming is how I would put it.
Oh yeah, and the last shootout part, I was happy to see Anthony Anderson show up again, because like I hear people like, you know, everyone knows about The Departed, but no one ever talks about Anthony Anderson being in this, and it was a great surprise seeing him, because like, I always assume I associate him with comedy and never with anything serious. But like seeing him in this, you go.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah, no, it's a very interesting casting, and I also really liked the other actor, James Badge Dale, who played the other trooper, who always seems to show up as playing these kind of like, you know, sort of slightly sleazy, shady henchmen. Probably he would be best known. He was in, I want to say Iron Man 3. He was in one of the Iron's Men, and almost playing the same kind of character, like someone who seems to be on the up and up, but is actually turns out to be really shady, and he does it very well.
Yeah, like the quadruple twist at the end, like ordinarily, that's a difficult thing to pull off, because like on like saying it out loud, it sounds very silly and stupid, but when you watch
that everybody is a mole pretty much. Yeah.
But in the moment you watch it and you think about it, it's like, oh yeah, that like it checks out, it makes sense, like within like the world that Scorsese, you know, made. So it's just a very even though this is like a quote unquote like a fun. Well, I mean, a lot of Scorsese movies are—they're not a lot.
Of all the younger characters, I mean, Dignan, Mark Wahlberg's character, is the only character other than the therapist who is who he says he is. Everybody else is working undercover or working as a mole or just being outright deceitful about who they are. He's the only one who. From the beginning of the movie to the end is exactly who he says he is.
Yeah, and I just love the But like he's always angry, no matter what, every single moment. You see him like explode multiple times. But as it was going on, I didn't, because I kind of knew some of it, because it's you hear about it because it's a big movie. But like I didn't quite know the end besides the rat thing, and I was generally caught off guard by the very end when Walter does survive.
That's good.
I knew like there were some big twists, but outside of that, like not much. And I
Just
forgot.
to skip to skip right to the ending, I didn't remember why Mark Wahlberg was the one who had the final shot in the movie, and it's basically just for revenge at that point, right?
Yeah, I think he's so offended. And like it just he I mean he'd already early in the movie he'd already quit the police force because Martin Sheen's character, who's also a genuinely decent person who and he ends up getting killed for it, he just quits in a rage. And but I think he's just so offended by the fact that all these people, all these duplicitous people kind of working for and against each other, led to, his mentor's death, that this is the only way he could, set the book straight, as it were.
Yeah, and he's like, I guess jokingly slash not jokingly threatening like to kill Matt Damon the whole time. Like the first few times it's like, oh, this is, oh, he's probably a hothead, like it's all a joke. But then as it keeps going, it's like, well, something's going to happen between them. And it's like in the slow buildup of, you're not quite sure when it's going to happen because the way the violence is so random. And like it's like realistic Scorsese. I mean, it's a Scorsese, but it's that realistic, random, very brutal violence where you're not sure when it's going to break out, but when it breaks out, it's very memorable and ugly, and it's not fun, even though it kind of is a little bit fun. Like it rides that balance in a very strange way.
Yeah,
Like it's still
I
kind of, yeah.
think when it comes to the violence, I think the only times that I didn't think that was like amusing in some way was whenever Jack Nicholson was somehow involved, like because he's get that look on his face that, I mean, he's the devil.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, and I always think of movies that kind of live on through their gifs. And you just got that one gif of like Jack Nicholson like nodding and leering. And it's just he just looks so creepy in it.
Yeah, and I kept the count on like how soon are we gonna hear the N-word in this movie? And it's like, oh, it's in the first 5 minutes. And it's like, okay,
Yeah, and
yeah.
they also dropped over almost 250 F words. I think it might have possibly broken a record. I'm not sure.
Summer of Sam has a has might has one of the highest, but this might be more. But I'm not sure. I have to like look at the numbers for that.
They're about the same length, aren't they?
I think the part is slightly longer. But I'm
Okay.
not positive about that. Right, one little detail that I that like just add to Jack Nicholson's just overall like insane performance was that like you see him in like animal prints a lot, and like it one looks gaudy and stupid, but like from like a character like that, it's like yeah, of course he'd dress like wear like he has like a tiger print tie at one point that looks very stupid, but at the same time it's like yeah, it makes sense in this, and it's also just like a subtle messaging of like he's a predator, he's like he's a top dog or top cat in this case, like and he like you don't fuck with him, and like and it even comes down to like he has like a breakfast morning robe that's like leopard print, and like it's very subtle, and but it's like a very nice little detail in his costuming that like I still love his costuming throughout the whole thing.
He likes a little glamour in his life. It's a little self-care.
Yeah. Right, made me think of Megan Sunday a little bit, if you're the mob boss.
She's not a mob boss.
She could be a mob boss. I mean,
It's
who
true.
have I been sending my money to this whole time?
So
Jeez.
So did you guys think there was... Do you think there was enough of Vera Farmiga in this, or did you want more? What's your guys' take on, on her in this?
You mean, are you asking if there's more to talk about, or...
No, just, like, do you think there was... Do you think that she should have been in more of the story, or do you think she was in just
the therapist? Yeah. No, I think. I think it was slightly implausible that they would both end up in a relationship with her. But no, I think that her character, was. I think that they did what they could with her. I don't think it's that she was superfluous or they needed to figure out a way to work her more into it.
Yeah, I feel like overthinking the character would make it feel like kind of ham-fisted to be like, well, we have to have one that links them in a more solid way than just them being on opposite sides of what's going on here. And she's great. She doesn't seem to be a very good therapist, or we don't see her with any other patients.
No, you definitely don't. You still should not get romantically involved with your patients, let alone two of your patients, at roughly the same time.
Yeah, even an ex-patient is probably a really bad idea.
Yeah, no, that's generally a violation of the therapist code. You don't get romantically involved with your patients. That never leads to anything good. As many erotic thrillers have told us, that never leads to anything good.
Well, the movie Tin Cup told me it's going to work out.
Oh, okay. Well, Kevin Costner, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I had a hard time writing notes for this one, because, this was so much fun. That, their song structure was like, oh, yeah, I need to write down stuff so I can remember, what happens in this. But, it's a nice break from the last time we did Braveheart, the last recording was Braveheart, and that is another epic, but not as fun and kind of ultimately a stupid, dumb movie that thinks it's smart. But this is the opposite, where it's a big epic movie that is actually smart and well executed in every area.
Yeah, the whole of the movie and the parts are great. Braveheart had some really great parts, but the whole was just kind of a mess.
Yeah.
Are either of you know anything? Do either of you know anything about Infernal Affairs at all?
No.
I mean, I know that this is inspired by it, and that Martin Scorsese had not seen it because he didn't want it to. Color his interpretation of it too much. I've not seen it myself, though.
Yeah, I don't know anything either. I was just curious. There's three movies. I wonder if it's a continuation or of the same story, or if it's just that they just made sequels. But I wonder if it was three movies and Scorsese kind of tore it down to one movie.
I'm not really sure. But
Spencer, do your other homework.
Well, on that note, I know Scorsese is a fan of the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, and this definitely feels like one of those where it's a huge story compact into a single movie with a bunch of characters. Mm. Although this doesn't go as extreme as the Battles movies go, because those movies will introduce maybe three or four times as many characters that you're supposed to keep track of. In this, kind of is a similar approach. And Goodfellas has some elements of battles without honor and humanity. I'm tired.
I understand.
Yeah.
How about that Ray Winstone?
How about that Ray Winstone?
It took me a while to realize that was him.
Oh, that's good.
He's a Punisher, or is that Ray, or is that a different Ray? Who is Punisher
allegedly,
Lord, though?
Allegedly did not get along with Jack Nicholson, which that takes some balls. If you go to act in a movie and you don't try to get along with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. They were swinging their dicks at each other, and who knows what happened. You were thinking of Ray Stevenson?
Ray Stevenson, okay.
Yeah.
Like the streak Ray Stevenson? Oh, that's Ray Stevens. Wow, there's a lot of Rays in show business.
Just the Punisher. Yeah, what was I going to say? The funny thing is, like, other than him being super, super loyal, like, I don't get really a read on his character, but it doesn't matter. Like, you basically know everything you need to know just by his actions and his words. And, like, it's almost like he is the, like, the glossary for, like, this is an important person, this has to be done now. Like, not only because he's first lieutenant or whatever to Jack Nicholson, but he just knows the stuff up and down, because that's every day of his life is that.
Right, he definitely brings that gravitas to the role, even if you're totally expecting him to also be a rat.
Wait, were you expecting him to be a rat?
Mr. French.
I knew it.
Yeah, or maybe he was a rat, but he got killed too soon to find out.
Yeah, that death scene is pretty... If I was in that situation, car on fire, already shot, crashed, probably concussed, that's probably what I would do.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Even though it's kind of silly that he blows his brains up, but then the car explodes even more, which doesn't make logical sense, but it's a movie, so it looks cool, and it's like it adds to the drama, so it's like yeah, it's fine, whatever.
I just assumed that the car was about to explode, not that his bullet accelerated it.
it happened one right after each other, so it's kind of like...
It hit a nearby gas tank.
Yeah,
but I was gonna say that the bullet passed through his skull, somehow ricocheted, went into the gas tank.
Yeah. Oh, and that's funny, because there's a deleted scene that's an extension of the scene where Matt Damon is learning about ballistics and he learns about the hollow point bullets. And in the extended scene, the instructor talks about a small caliber bullet, how you can't really tell by exit wound where it came from, because once it enters the cranium, it'll bounce around in there. And he tells a story about it coming out of a victim's ass one time, which makes Matt Damon laugh in the scene. But maybe that's what happened with Ray Winstone. It was a small caliber, and it just
maybe
bounced off the top of his skull, went through the gas station after going through his ass.
Yeah. So, this doesn't make me sound stupid. So, Nicholson is a FBI informant who's also a mob boss. How does that work exactly?
I mean, that's something that is... happened in real life quite a bit. I mean, he just basically the cops will let him do his thing as long as he provides information about other gangsters.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't. Can I say, can you say for certain if the cops knew he was killing people? I mean, possibly, but I mean, it's pretty common for cops to let one person get away with a lot of crime as long as they are providing names of other criminals.
Okay. As
it's keeping them in business, not solving the problem of crime.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but that little element was a little confusing, because like a shit ton of stuff happens, and so like at a certain point, I was like, I'm not sure what's happening, but I don't really care.
Did either of you see the Johnny Depp movie where he plays Whitey Bulger?
No.
Is it called
Black Mass?
Black Mass, there we go.
I did not.
I believe in that movie, Whitey is also an FBI informant, and I think, Jack Nicholson is supposed to be partially based on that.
Right, correct, yeah.
I was happy to see Kevin Corrigan in this, but then I remembered, oh yeah, he's like in every Scorsese movie after a certain point.
Yeah, he's stirring the sauce.
Yep. Make sure don't let it stick.
Yeah, and
I kind of love that abuse of like the scene where it's like, you gotta stop fucking selling drugs with your idiot, cut everybody. It's like Kevin Corrigan, even the guy in prison, Leo meets, that talks about, no offense, but he's kind of a moron or whatever he says. It's like, everyone thinks this guy's an asshole. That's really funny. But yeah. Where's he at the end of the movie?
He disappears, like, I think after the bodega fight, he disappears.
Yeah, after Jack Nicholson comes and visits him with his leopard print tie for the first time.
Yeah,
we don't see him again.
Yeah, it's like a Joker suit. Like, it might as well just be like the Joker all over again.
Yeah, he loves playing the head of mobs, or... No, wait.
I don't know what to say about this movie. It hasn't been said already.
It's good. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's great, actually.
Yeah,
that's the difficulty, right? Like, I mean, we're not gonna bring anything new to what we saw or anything like that, but...
I do like that Matt Damon gets to use his own accent, like he does in Good Will Hunting. I'm always pleased when because I was just rewatching the Avengers movies today, and even though Idris Elba was only in Infinity War for a short time, he gets to use his own accent, and I just that makes me happy. Mm-hmm. That must be such a relief for actors that they don't have to put on another accent; they can just slip right back into their own natural accent.
Oh. Yeah. So Damon actually does have a Boston accent in real life.
Oh yeah, have you ever seen Good Will Hunting?
No.
He pronounces where you go to school when you're 5 years old. He pronounces it kindergarten. It's great. That's his actual accent. So.
Oh, does his best buddy Affleck have an accent?
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh. They grew up in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, so did Harvard Bar, then.
Mark Wahlberg's accent is authentic too.
Yeah, I knew that about Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard his accent, but like, this is a dumb tangent. But there's a podcast that I think it's pretty much done by now. A Sklarbo Country, the Sklar brothers did a thing for like maybe 7 or 8 years, and they had a comedian friend Dan Van Kirk come on a lot as Mark Wahlberg. And that kind of ruined Wahlberg for me for a long time, because whenever I hear him talk, I would always immediately think of Dan Van Kirk doing, like, a comedy version of him. And, like, this... And that's why, like, Boogie Nights was, like, kind of, like, a weird watch for me, because, like, I just want to laugh at everything he says, just because I always think of, like, the Dan Van Kirk version of it. Mm-hmm. But this movie kind of, like... cured me of it. It's like, okay, like it finally broke that, like, that curse of, like, I always associate Wahlberg with Dan Van Kirk. Now it's like, okay, that can, like, take him a little more seriously. It's like, he's not like a goofball character. I mean he's a goofball idiot in real life, but, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like I have him separated. Like, I know Mark Wahlberg is a good actor. He's in a couple of movies that I love, like this one. He's in I Heart Huckabees, which I don't care what that says about me. I love that movie.
Shooter, the Antoine Fuqua movie.
Yeah, that one? No, I haven't seen that one.
It's a good movie.
But I also have the clownish, goofy, We Hate Movies imitation version of him for... any occasion. So it's like I've got them perfectly separated, and none will the two meet.
Yeah, I mean, he's easy to make fun of. There's a lot to make fun of with him, which is also like part of the problem. But what are your guys' like favorite like Scorsese movies?
I'm very partial to Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. But I watched Mean Streets for the first time a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and I really, really love Mean Streets. I think it's his smallest, possibly most personal movie, And yeah, you know, besides the fact that young Harvey Keitel looks like what the kids would call a snack in it, it's just a really, really well done, very heart wrenching movie. So it would be either of those two.
Mean Streets is one of my favorites. That was the first Scorsese that made me go like, oh, holy shit, this guy's great. Because the first one I saw would have been Shutter Island in theater, which I enjoyed, but I have not gone back to it. And have kind
it doesn't, of it doesn't feel like, it's like Hugo. It doesn't feel like what you think of when you think of a Scorsese movie. They're both good movies, but neither of them feel like a Scorsese movie.
Yeah, and like Taxi Driver was like one of the rare movies that were like everyone says is like a like amazing and perfect, and the watcher like, oh, like this lived up to the hype, like exactly.
Mm. Yeah, Taxi Driver, the Goodfellas, obviously. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which is one of his earlier films, is really good drama about the single woman just trying to make it, working at restaurants. She starts dating Kris Kristofferson, and you know that makes my heart swoon every time. But the movie itself is really good. His first movie, Who's That Knocking at My Door, is also really good. You can like see the stem of everything he was gonna make just starting from that, which is really amazing. And then I also really like Silence.
I haven't seen Silence yet. I want to. I have not seen it yet.
I was going to say, nobody talks about that anymore. It, like, disappeared after it came out. And it's just kind of... It's beautiful because it's all taking place in Japan. It's got all the religious things that he puts into his movies in it in a way that is... Because of the period piece way it is... It doesn't have the same, like, sin and sinner thing that he'll often put with, like, the gangsters, like, oh, I'm also very deeply religious going on thing. And it's Andrew Garfield knocks it out of the freaking park in it, which I can't think of another movie that I'm like, oh, man. I mean, The Social Network he's good in, but, yeah.
Yeah. But have you seen the original Silence, the Shinoda one?
No, I haven't. Is it good?
According to Tony Stella, it's good. But Tony Stella hates every remake of a movie he likes. So he's a little bit biased. He was on Wrong Reel recently talking about the ninja movies like from the 60s. And he went on a rant about the Silence remake. But,
Get back to drawings, Tony.
I'm sure Criterion and like Arrow are going to employ him even more.
Oh, sure. Especially with this endorsement I just gave him.
I don't think he'll hear this. I hope he doesn't.
But how do you guys feel about The King of Comedy?
That's my favorite Scorsese. It's like
I like The King of Comedy. It's creepy when you watch it now in terms of like internet culture and just entitled men who think that they have earned the right to be the center of attention. So it's when you watch it through the lens of the present, it really lands in a different way. But I like that one a lot.
Yeah, I love how cringy and like it's so cringy. It's hilarious. Kind of like
it's his dark. It's his darkest movie.
Yeah, and there are just like some parts in it that's like it feels like the De Niro character like is getting off to being rejected and like being like there's like a whole lot of stuff you can look at like dig into it. Like there's a part where he's getting choked by Jerry Lewis and like he seems to enjoy it a little bit and it's like what is going on with this guy? He's such a such a creep. But the movie to me is like that's a Scorsese that like I'm like this is like 100% perfect. Like there's none better.
I don't even know which one's my favorite at this point.
And Irishman is up there. I wish it was an hour longer. Like I like the pace and the characters that one so much.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I thought Irishman moved along just fine.
Yeah. I like the second half of the Irishman. when they stopped trying to pretend they were ever young people. Obviously, these people were born ancient.
Okay, I didn't notice the CG very much.
It's not. I'm not even talking about the CG, like, because it goes beyond that. Like the way they're all hunched over, it's like these guys can. It's because they're having a hard time standing up. There's more to it than just the wrinkles on their face.
All right.
Yeah, it just picked up more once Al Pacino showed up, I feel like.
Al Pacino and his Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, The Departed, it's great. Everyone should watch it. It's easily available. But the other Best Picture nominees, it's always interesting to see what else, because usually it's kind of forgettable, is Babel, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen. And
yeah, one of those is on my list of notable movies. It was Little Miss Sunshine. I put that on my list of notable movies.
Please don't say Babel.
It was not Letters from Iwo Jima, which I don't even remember that movie. I thought it was a documentary.
Oh. Yeah, Little Miss Sunshine I have not seen in years, but like I loved it when I saw it in high school a few times, but I just have not gone back to it in a while. But Babel, like
Letters from Iwo Jima, you're saying?
Little Miss Sunshine. Maybe my brain. Oh, I thought you.
It's a rough year for movies. And when I was preparing to do this episode, I was looking at a Wikipedia's page on movies released in 2006, and it was a lot of remakes, a ton of not great sequels. There was a Madea movie, there was a Larry the Cable Guy movie, and it was also the year my least favorite movie of all time came out, which is the remake of The Wicker Man.
I've avoided the Wicker Man remake. The original.
Oh, you should continue avoiding the remake of the Wicker Man at all costs, because it is absolutely shamelessly atrocious.
But I love Nicolas Cage.
There are plenty of other Nicolas Cage movies. You do not need to watch this one.
Just rewatch Wild at Heart if you want Nick Cage.
If you want to see like crazy Nicolas Cage, rewatch Mandy or watch The Color Out of Space, because those are both genuinely good movies. Mandy is a classic in the making. I just love Mandy so much. But if you want to see Nicolas Cage wearing a bear suit and punching out women, then watch the remake of The Wicker Man.
Yeah,
maybe I could just watch like a best of clips.
Oh, there's tons of best of clips. You can watch the whole, you know, the bees are in my eyes. There's like a ton of clips of just that online.
Yeah, it made perfect sense to give a movie with empowered women to Neil LaBute, who famously who's a bit misogynist. You know, it makes perfect sense.
I was gonna say, famously lover of women, Neil LaBute. Yeah, that was the that was a curious choice, to be sure.
Yeah, and other Oscar movies are like Devil Wears Prada, which I've seen parts of, and I like in like Dreamgirls and Blood Diamond, but there's a whole lot of stuff that like is kind of forgotten, pop culture wise. Besides,
there's a couple of good things. Like on my list, I had four movies on my list that I thought was worth pointing out. Again, I really liked Little Miss Sunshine. I thought that was it's hard to do a comedy about that in which there are characters suffering from mental illness. There's another character suffering from a drug addiction. It's hard to do that well, and I think that they balance that pretty good. Another one that I would mention as being a worthwhile movie is Hard Candy.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that is a very, very creepy movie. And also a rare movie in which Patrick Wilson plays a complete and utter scumbag in it. He's, usually it's kind of like, horror dad at this point, because he was in Insidious and he was in the Conjuring movies. And he just kind of plays this very, stolid, suburban husband and father role very well, and here he's just such a creep and he's so good at it, and you've got a maybe teenage or early 20s, the best Ellen Page. She's amazing in it. Another one I would recommend is The Descent, which is probably one of the best horror movies of the OOs. Do not watch it if you're claustrophobic. I highly advise against that. And Marie Antoinette would be another one that I may not be everybody's cup of tea if you are not into kind of only vaguely inspired by real events, historical dramas that have very what's the word I'm looking for, where the costumes and the music don't really go with the time period. You're not gonna like this one because it's all that. It's all very much like style and a look, but it's genuinely a very good movie too. She manages to make a long vilified historical figure very sympathetic.
Yeah, it's been after seeing her remake of what's that movie? The Beguiled. I've been curious.
The Beguiled.
Yeah, because I love Beguiled. I didn't even know it was a remake at the time until I saw people complain on like Twitter and stuff.
Yeah. Have you seen the one with Clint Eastwood, the original?
No. I hear it's good, but I'm kind of have no interest, honestly.
It's got a different tone because he is. I feel that the remake. Colin Farrell is a little less creepy than he should be, considering that he's like playing a lot of teenage and adolescent age girls against each other. And in the original Clint Eastwood, he was very much like just like oozing malevolence. He was just very, very creepy. And which is funny is in the book, the character is even more. There's just no mistaking that he is a creep who means to do these characters harm. If you haven't seen Marie Antoinette, it's a beautiful movie. I mean, it's absolutely a feast for the eyes.
It's been on my like Netflix DVD queue for like 5 years, but that DVD queue is like in almost in 400 at this point. So, eventually, he'll get there. I don't know when exactly, but
don't be too enthusiastic about it.
Okay, I won't. I keep pushing stuff back. But relaying back to an episode we did a few months ago on Timbuktu, the same director of Timbuktu, Sissoko, had a movie, Bamako, come out that year. That was, I think it was the first one he did that was produced by Danny Glover. And Danny Glover, I believe, does appear in it. But Bamako is one of the more accessible African films of like the last 20 years, and it's a Sissoko, so it's good. And I won't go too far about talking about that, but my main one for 2006 is one of my favorite movies, period. Like it's a movie I watch like every few years and. I keep getting more and more stuff out of it. The Science of Sleep, it's my favorite Gondry movie. This was the first time I saw a movie where like I felt like the character on screen is me, with and all the good and bad ways. And it like and as I get older, I still feel like I'm just like the Galaxy or Brunel character. Like I still. This is all hits me on like very deeply personal level, and it's Gondry and it's whimsical and about emotions and love and it's not as oppressive as Eternal Sunshine could get at times, but it's kind of like the more fun version and a little bit tapping into this similar stuff. But Signs of Sleep, like I still have the same DVD I had since I was 17. So it's this point's 12 years old.
Yeah, and the lettering hasn't worn all off the off it like they used to with cassette tapes.
It's starting to a little bit. I should upgrade, but I kind of don't want to. Cause I went to like 5 different stores where I live to find a DVD. Like, is that important to me? And I kind of like it just means a lot just to even have it like in my apartment. But And besides that, Jackass number two. It makes me laugh. It's stupid. I like Jackass. It's the most mean-spirited of them. There's a couple things. There's one gag toward the end that's, like, kind of, like, generally a little, like, okay, that's a little too far. But for most part, it's the one I like the most.
They're the modern-day Tati, right?
No. Closer to Buster Keaton. J-Dog, you?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I mean, there were good movies that came out this year, like Casino Royale is kind of outstanding, right? Okay, that's it. The Inside Man, Inside Man, which we have an entire podcast where we talk about that, so yeah, that's still one of my absolute favorites.
Megan Dooley?
Mm-hmm. I guess Pan's Labyrinth, another one. Crazy.
Ooh.
Good.
Oh, you know, I completely overlooked that came out. You know, I was probably just focusing on American releases. Shame on me. That would be on my list too. That is a flawless motion picture.
Excellent. Yes.
I watched it on DVD to the point that it stopped working when I had it.
You wore out the DVD?
Yes, I did. Or maybe it was fucked up to begin with. But after like maybe 10 watches or so, it started to skip and not work.
That's kind of an accomplishment.
I know. Not the only DVD I did that to.
I don't want to hear about your copy of the Great Bikini Off-Road Adventure.
I got anyway. That from you.
Well, yes. And it was in perfect condition when I sent it. Children of Men is the movie I want to talk about most, because even though I think a lot of people know about Children of Men, it doesn't get talked about that much anymore. Like, it's Caron, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He is such an impressive creative director. Like, whoever he's working with the cinematography, they really know how to make, like, scenery, background, anything stand out along and complement the actors. And Children of Men, it's got the famous, you know, the car chase shooting scene. The camera's doing crazy things. And they're the way they make the dystopian world that the movie takes place in somehow still look gorgeous.
It has the best opening of, like, any movie I've ever seen.
Refresh my memory.
He goes to the coffee shop, and then he walks out, and then there's a bomb explodes in a coffee shop.
Just explosion. That's what I thought, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it gets your attention, keeps you the entire time. And as a sci-fi, it feels kind of overwhelming at this point to have a post-apocalyptic sci-fi.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe not the best time to watch this motion picture.
But it is really good if you're up for it. You know, I say turn off all the lights, put it on the biggest screen you can find, because it is overwhelming and great. And The Host also came out this year. Bong Joon-ho, I think, right?
Yeah, Bong
Joon-ho. Yeah, that sounds right, yeah.
Yeah. The only other thing I guess I would talk about is a movie made by an asshole. It's called Apocalypto.
Yeah. I've never seen that. I've never seen any of Mel Gibson's movies that aren't in English.
Oh. Well, Apocalypto is also visually stunning, and he makes a very good adventure kind of movie, you know, adventure slash horror almost. Movie about this man who gets, you know, he lives in, I don't even know, it's somewhere. I don't want to be as insensitive.
Is that another Mel Gibson, a man about, like a man of peace who in a movie that's insanely violent?
No, he's not a man of peace, but does, I mean, things do have to get violent. Basically, he gets kidnapped and almost enslaved, and escapes, and he's trying to make it back home to the village before a certain thing happens. I really don't want to spoil it. I'm not really worried about spoilers, but it is fun just to see it from the beginning to the end. And it's done so well. You know, Mel Gibson actually has a pretty good hand at directing. He's just an asshole.
Yeah, among other things. Okay, so I was expecting you to pick Paprika, because I didn't want to steal it from you. But Paprika.
Oh, yeah, Paprika.
Satoshi Kon. It's fucking amazing. And, like, it's very similar similar to Inception a little bit. I think it predates Inception by, like, a year or two.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. But, Satoshi Kon, watch his movies in general.
Yeah, Satoshi Kon does anime movies in such a cool-looking, unique style, and you can tell he's a huge fan of movies himself, because you'll see, what's the one that's about an Millennium Actress, right?
Yeah, about Susiko Hara, kind of, sort of.
Right, besides just having an entire movie based on him, like, he sprinkles in all these movie references into the other works he has, and Paprika has these, I'm just gonna spoil this, there's a scene that completely remakes the tussle scene. Fight sounds too big. The tussle scene in what is that Audrey Hepburn movie with Gregory Peck?
Sabrina.
Roman Holiday. Oh. Yeah, there's a scene by a fountain where people start to get into a scrap, and he recreates it in this movie in an animated sequence, and it's like picture perfect. It's so good. I mean, I'm not talking like he drew over the image from the movie, but he does such a great imitation. You see it, and you're like, oh, I know exactly what that's from. Assuming you've seen
Roman Holiday.
Wow, that won't stay in my head. Anyway. Paprika and Hard Candy were movies that I saw in a couple of my film classes. So somebody really did like 2006, apparently.
Okay. Yeah, as a quick thing, on my film blog site, I reviewed a 2006 movie, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time. And it's like this teen girl who's, like, I think in high school, and she learns she can travel back in time. And forward in time if she, like, runs really fast and jumps or whatever. And it starts out as, like, she starts just, like, to not be embarrassed, and then she starts, like, kind of fuck up her life and change her relationships with people. And so it's a very nice little, like, coming-of-age time travel movie. And it's, like, in, like, the fourth or fifth adaptation of the story, and there's one by Obayashi, who passed away, like, a month or two ago, from early 80s. But I've been trying to track down legally for a while, but it's Obayashi, so it's hard to actually find his movies outside of house. But, The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, it's a nice little, it's just a nice little anime film that no one really talks about, but it should be talked about more. And,
I haven't seen it, sorry.
It's fine. Well, if you ever do your sci-fi podcast again, it'd be a good episode.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. But, so, Gina, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully next time I won't be as tired and in the middle of classes and shit. But, I believe you do a podcast about Kills by Kills.
I do. I am the co-host of the Kill by Kill podcast, in which we talk about horror movies, mostly focusing on the characters. Some more recent episodes have included 10 to Midnight with our guest Eric Siska from We Hate Movies. We also have episodes coming up on Dr. Giggles, Bride of Chucky, and we just finished a almost 4-year-long stretch covering all the movies in the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street series. So that is, you could just look us up on Kill by Kill.
Quite an accomplishment for you guys. Congratulations.
Thank you. It was exhausting.
I enjoyed every minute.
Thank you.
For some reason, Patrick just won't return my phone calls. If you could talk to him for me,
I will do my best.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard our Braveheart episode, but we were saying, like, it's so violent, and it turns to a slasher at some point. It could be a Kill by Kill episode.
Yeah, you guys should look into it.
Yeah. I mean, some movies are too good to talk about, because you can't really hyper focus on certain little details of it to make it more entertaining. Mm-hmm. But right. Yeah, I mean, this would almost qualify as a horror movie with all the violence in it.
And there's a whole, like, slasher segment towards the end
that is Braveheart.
And Braveheart, it's pretty stupid. Jesus. Yeah.
I had forgotten, like, I remembered it being violent. That's violent is not the right word. It's like, it is horror movie stuff. It's pretty great.
Fuck, what is his name? The makeup artist. Never mind. Tom Sex Machine. That guy. I can't remember
his name. Tom Savini.
Yeah, like, he wishes he could do, like, I mean, he did great stuff, but, like, the Braveheart violence is, like, even gorier than what he did as Peak, which is really saying a lot.
But, yeah, I don't agree with you, but...
Okay. this comes out in late July, I think.
Okay.
Mid or late July. So,
Hello, listeners. What's the world like now?
Yeah, so a vampire podcast, your baby. Pete, you talk about it.
You keep saying it's my baby. I don't agree to do that.
You're the one who asked.
I'm the one who's editing it, so I guess it's my baby.
You approached me about the idea.
Right. It's okay, fine. It's Sarah and mine's baby, then. And Spencer has been nice enough to join us talking about vampire media, movies, comics, video games, in our podcast, The Dead Travel Fast. By the time this episode drops, we probably started on the next series. We did an initial three, doing Dracula 31, Nosferatu from before movies were even made, and the 1950s horror of Dracula starring Christopher Lee, the first in the Hammer series. And we're also reading along in the Dracula, the novel Dracula, one chapter at a time. This series that we're currently cooking up is kind of a non-vampires thing. Not that it doesn't actually have vampires, but, you know, there's those movies where it's like, well, technically it's a vampire movie, but are they really vampires?
Yeah.
Spencer, do you want to talk about what movies we are talking about in that?
One will be The Transfiguration, which is a modern-day take on the Romero movie Martin. The movie Martin with, I think Gina might be on that one, I don't know. I think she might like the movie a little bit.
Depends on whether a check cashes or not.
Exactly. I'll get back to you. I'll let you know.
And the third one is Trouble Every Day with, we're going to try to...
Ooh, that's a good one.
Try to get Marcus and Scott from Zebras America, because they're the most passionate Claire Denis fans I know. Mm. And Marcus has interviewed Claire Denis for his blog, Penland Empire.
That's really cool. Like
10 years? No. 5 years ago or so? It's been a few years.
Can he get me her number?
I doubt
Patrick
it.
Patrick get me her number? What's Patrick Hamilton's number? Okay, sorry. Anyway, the podcast is available in the usual spots, iTunes, or it's not called iTunes, it's called Apple Podcast, and Stitchers and such.
Yeah, so see you guys for, I think the next pairing is 1986, I think it's 86, and that's good. She's got to have it with Platoon.
That's quite a jarring pairing there.
Practically the same movie.
Yeah. I think it's
very similar. Very similar themes. Very similar themes.
I don't feel. No, it's Girl Six. It's Girl Six with. We haven't actually picked the other pairing yet, but.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Girl Six with hopefully Dave from The Realist, because he likes that movie. Because the guy who did something an Angry Inch is in it. John Cameron Mitchell.
John Cameron Mitchell.
Yeah,
that's cool. I didn't know that. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. So.
Yeah, that's why he picked it.
That's cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so look out for that, and see you guys next time.
Bye. Bye.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.